ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's thrilling. It's a first time for me. It's amazing.
The main pressure was from me and from a sense that I couldn't, this one had to work.
Hello, I'm Claire Nichols, and this is your special Booker episode of The Book Show.
Thrilled, delighted, and also a bit scared, of course. It's quite a circus, as you know.
I wanted briefly to be a monk, I didn't know any writers. I didn't know any artists. There was no, you know, our family, there just weren't people doing that kind of thing.
The older I get, the more writing seems like a kind of openness to experience that I don't have in the rest of my life.
The Booker Prize is arguably the most prestigious literary prize in the English-speaking world. It is open to novels written in English, and the winner, which will be announced on the 10th of November, well, that author gets £50,000. They go into the history books alongside writers like Margaret Atwood, Michael Ondaatje, and Peter Carey, and they can expect a life-changing increase in book sales. There are six novels on this year's Booker shortlist. Flashlight by Susan Choi, The Land in Winter by Andrew Miller, The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by Kieran Desai, Audition by Katie Kitamura, Flesh by David Saloy, and The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz. Today I am going to take you through these six wonderful novels. You're going to meet the authors, you'll find out what inspired these books, and I promise you at the end of this hour, you will consider yourself something of a Booker expert. So let's start in a psychologist's office. Louisa is 10 years old. Her American mum is sick, and her Korean dad, well, he's gone missing, presumed dead. And Louisa, probably unsurprisingly, has been acting out. This is the beginning of Flashlight by Susan Choi. Now, this book, it's a family story and it's something of a literary thriller. It's a total page-turner of a book which follows a very sad family living between Japan and America and also grapples with Korean history. Now, the author, Susan Choi, is here. Susan, welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Maybe you can set the scene for what is happening in this initial scene. What's going on for this kid when we first meet her?
Yeah, when we first meet her, she had gone to live abroad for a short time with her two parents, and then she's come back to the U.S. with one parent. Something's gone terribly wrong. Her dad is gone. As you say, her mother is very unwell. They're living with relatives, and she is a tough kid. She doesn't like to talk about her feelings, and she has started really acting out in school. She's been kind of a little terror in school. If there's something not nailed down, she steals it. And so she's wound up in the office of a child psychologist who she's kind of sent to by her school. And the story is really just the two of them sitting there trying to avoid him, he trying to, you know, get somewhere with her. And he's not so bad at what he does because he does end up kind of breaking her shell open a little bit.
Can you tell us anything about what happens to her dad or what the understanding is of what has happened to this man on this trip to Japan?
He disappears during a walk on the beach with Louisa. They go for a walk. They have their flashlight. They're going to go see the sunset, and then they're going to look at the stars once the sun has gone down. They've got their constellation wheel, and it's a lovely father-daughter excursion. Something happens, and Louisa wakes up alone on the beach. She's soaking wet. Her dad is not to be found. He's presumed drowned, but there's reason to believe that maybe that's not the full explanation.
And his biography is interesting because he is ethnically Korean, but raised in Japan. And this is a novel, I think, all about outsiders in a way, right? Because we've got this character never really fitting in Japan, then moving to America, never really fitting in there. Then we've got his wife, Anne, you know, who goes to live in Japan, can't get out of the house. We've got the daughter, Louisa, who comes from a cross-cultural relationship, doesn't feel like she fits in America, doesn't feel like she fits in Japan either. I mean, what were you interested in exploring about this idea of otherness or outsiderness in this novel?
Yeah, I think this is a case of a situation or a community or kind of a historical event preceding the book and being something that I found so interesting that I kept thinking, oh, I wish I could write about that. And it is this community of ethnic Koreans called the Zainichi, who were Korean people who ended up on the Japanese archipelago during, you know, those 30 years or 35 years, 1910 to 1945, that Korea was forcibly seized by Japan and made into a colony. And so all the Korean people of that peninsula became subjects of the Japanese Empire, and many of them ended up on the Japanese archipelago for work or against their will for a variety of different, usually not great reasons. And then when Japan loses World War II and has to give up Korea as a colony, all of these ethnic Korean people kind of were just washed up, so to speak, on the beach of Japan with no status. They weren't citizens. They weren't citizens of Korea either, which, you know, ends up two countries at the end of all this. It's North Korea and South Korea. They actually had no country and no nowhere to be. And so there's this whole community of kind of, I think of them as almost marooned ethnic Koreans who end up staying in Japan very disadvantaged. You know, they're not even second-class citizens. They're not citizens. They have very limited economic opportunity. A lot of them end up in sort of marginal or organized crime situations. And I was so fascinated by this community. I'd been researching them for years and reading about them. And I just thought, oh, you know, I rarely do this because it's tough. But I thought, I just really, really want to write a character who grows up this way. And that ends up being Louisa's dad. And I think I was fascinated by all of those displacements, you know, being Korean, but ending up in Japan. But then the Japan you end up in ends up being a different country yet. The place you came from is also now a different country. Like, what do you do?
Yeah, well, how do you fit in anywhere? I have to say, Susan, the family in this story, our central family, we've got Louisa and we've got her parents. He's often called Cirque. She's Anne. They are not a happy family, even before kind of crisis befalls them, before he goes missing, before the mother becomes sick. There's something very sad right at the core of this family. Why is this a story that you wanted to tell?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you put it so well, you know, when you said, oh, Louisa's this product of a cross-cultural marriage and doesn't really fit in. And I think that does fascinate me, you know. As I said earlier, there are autobiographical elements in here that are kind of then blown up and distorted and made more extreme, I think, for the sake of a story and also my maybe perverse psychology of just, you know, liking speculating along these lines. But I'm the product of such a union, you know, cross-cultural marriage between two very, very different people, a Jewish mother from Detroit, Michigan, and, you know, Korean father from Seoul, not via Japan, as this father is. And, you know, my parents' marriage, I think, does fascinate me. It is my point of origin. They're the two people in the world, probably apart from my own children, the most important to me. Their marriage was not successful. They would both admit it right away. Interestingly, divorce was just about the best idea they ever had. And then they remained really good friends until, you know, the end of my father's life not too long ago. My mother's still with me. And I'm kind of fascinated by, well, you know, something drew them together, right? There's some basis for that friendship. But then coexisting in the same space, they couldn't do it. And so it's that push-pull of like, what pulls people like this that are so different together toward each other? It's easier to see what pushes them apart. And so I'm probably still exploring that. I mean, my poor parents, they have come in for fictional treatment in previous novels too, and they've been very nice about it.
Good on the parents. Yeah. Susan Choi, I'm guessing you'll be flying over to London for the Booker ceremony. How are you feeling about all of that?
I'm so nervous and excited, mostly excited, but not a small amount nervous. In situations like this, I tend to fixate on pretty low stakes aspects that to me seem absolutely terrifying. And in this case, the question is, what does one wear? Mm-hmm. What does one wear? I don't know. I'm taking as my plus one of my very best friends who just has a cool head in these situations and always knows how to dress. So she is going to be my lifeline for this. And at some point, I'll figure out what to wear and I'll calm down a little.
All right. Well, I can't wait to see what you wear.
Oh, no. That adds a bit to the pressure. I'm just kidding.
That's Susan Choi talking about her Booker shortlisted novel, Flashlight. And today on The Book Show, I'm taking you through the six novels on this year's shortlist with some help from producer Sarah Lestrange.
Hello. And as you know, Claire, I always love Booker time of the year. And do you want to hear some stats on this year's shortlist?
Absolutely.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things is that there are no debut novels at all. All of the authors are firmly established writers. There's even one previous winner. Two have been shortlisted before, and then that means there are three who are new to the golden glow of shortlisting. I think out of all of this, Penguin Random House is the biggest winner because four of the six titles are published by them. So wow. No matter which way it goes, I feel like they are having a boon. There's one Indian author, three American nationals, one British Hungarian and one British author. And then something else we always want to know is the gender split. So there's mm-hmm. three men and three women. And here's something else I feel we should mention. You know, this year's Booker judging panel, it's not just made up of literary legends like Roddy Doyle and Kylie Reid, which is amazing in and of itself. There's also a Hollywood celeb involved this year, Sarah Jessica Parker. She's one of the judges.
Yeah, this seems to be what everyone wants to talk to me about this year. Can you believe that Sarah Jessica Parker is one of the judges? I do wonder, Sarah, how much sway a Hollywood celebrity like SJP might have on the panel?
I mean, who knows? But I will note that there's three American books on this year's shortlist. And even as I was reading them, I was thinking, I wonder if Sarah Jessica Parker chose this book. but it has been a while since an American won the prize. The last was George Saunders back in 2017. And the only other American author ever to win was Paul Beatty in 2016.
And of course, we should remember that the Booker Prize was only opened up to American writers in 2014. But let's hear from a British novelist now. We're moving to another post-war novel. This is The Land in Winter by Andrew Miller. It's set in West Country England in the early 1960s. And this was a time, Sarah, when society was on the cusp of big changes.
And there's some luminous writing in this book, Claire, at a sentence level. It's just beautiful, which I think is enhanced by the snow that's covering everything and causing a lot of drama because this was a brutal and long winter. But it takes this small tableau, a study of the inner lives of two couples set against this changing cultural landscape.
The Land in Winter is the 10th novel by British author Andrew Miller.
And it's the second time he's been shortlisted.
Yeah, and it's exciting. And it's sort of 20-something years since the last shortlisting on the book. And so it's I'm a little different. The book is a little different. But, yeah, it's still very exciting.
And which book was that for?
That was for Oxygen, which is my third novel. And actually, it was Peter Carey, an Australian writer, who kind of took the prize that year.
So that was for True History of the Carey Gang.
That's right, exactly. And that was actually he was lovely. I really enjoyed hanging out with him.
Well, let's talk about your latest Booker shortlisted novel, The Land in Winter. I mean, it's in the title, but it's cold in this book. Tell me about the big cold snap in England in 1962, 1963.
Snow lay on the ground from end of December until sort of mid-March. And it was just, whole towns even, not just villages. Villages were cut off. Many of them were cut off, particularly in the southwest. Sort of buried the country, or the roads disappeared, really. I mean, I say it was fun probably for a while. The kids certainly loved it for a little while, and then it just became really hard work, and then it just wouldn't go away. It just stayed there. Sort of had the whole country in its grip, and I mean, it was so cold the sea froze for a mile, off the coast, and that just doesn't happen. That's just kind of really freakish stuff. So, life changed quite suddenly.
Yeah. For me, this is the post-war era. I find this time fascinating for authors because the impact of World War II is still evident, but everyone's meant to be moving on as well.
Absolutely. No, I think that puts it perfectly because it is exactly that sort of tension between a sense, a growing sense that life, the possibilities of life, what one might do and expect are beginning to change. But also, there's been this obviously sort of massive event sort of in the rearview mirror, 5 years of total war in which the characters in this book had, obviously they were teenagers during that time. They weren't quite fully adult. They hadn't taken an active part in the war, but they were, this obviously had massively shaped their sense of things and of themselves and of the world. But now it's 1962. Now the soundtrack is changing, quite literally, of course. You're right. There's a tension there between looking back at something which, in some ways, an experience like that is always unresolved, and also being drawn forwards into the bright lights, or apparently bright lights, of the 1960s.
Of the future. And we have two couples. We've got Eric and Irene and Bill and Rita. Both women are pregnant. They're living in this small rural town. They're each other's closest neighbours, but they're not naturally drawn to each other, are they? For a whole range of reasons.
No, they're not. I mean, there's all kinds of things. I mean, for the women, I mean, one of the things you write about Britain at pretty much any time, you've got to write about class, and it's unavoidable whether you want to do it or not. The woman who lives on the farm, although
Rita.
No farmer's wife really, she's a very different sort of background, but she's a working class woman, and Irene is a upper middle class woman, so we've got to be quite sort of particular here. And yet, of course, as you say, they're both youngish, they're similar age, late 20s. They're both in the early stages of pregnancy, and are both in marriages that are, they're not terrible, or not terrible yet anyway, but they're creaking a bit. And
the ice is freezing over.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, that's it. So they find some kind of solace and refuge in each other. And I really want to just, I love writing about friendship. I think it's a great sort of subject. And, the novel is often thought of as, maybe where we write about sort of romantic love endlessly. But actually, in some ways, I'm more interested in friendship.
Yeah, and I mean, none of them are satisfied, are they? The village doctor, Eric, he's holding secrets. Bill, he's from a wealthy family, but he's sort of stepped away from that and he's farming now, but he's experimenting. They're all trying to find space for themselves, which is easier for the men than the women, isn't it?
It is definitely easier for the men. And there's, I mean, this is one of the great sort of themes of the early 1960s, what women might have, what women might do. And it's, if you read the fiction of the early 1960s, it's a recurrent theme. You read someone like Penelope Mortimer, it's a wonderful book of hers I found, which is not so well known now, but I think should be. And it's called When Daddy's Gone A-Hunting. And it is about the middle-class women going out of their minds in quite comfortable circumstances, but with nothing to do. So this is a thing that lots of people are starting to, not just starting, but it's we're building up towards some sense of change.
This is early 60s, we've yet to see the full revolution of the late 60s.
Absolutely. And those, you know, the early 60s and late 60s are very different times. A huge amount of obviously happens in that decade.
Andrew, the Booker judges obviously loved your book. Are you proud of your book too?
What I'm proud of is keeping going, really. If I think of anything, I'm proud of the fact that basically from, you know, for decades now, I've been able to keep going as a writer. It's not a simple thing to do. It's a very uncertain and life lots of ways. There's no kind of financial security to it at all. That I'm quite proud of. I feel like that's a sort of surviving, you know, of keeping going.
Andrew Miller's Booker shortlisted novel is called The Land in Winter.
It's really a gorgeous read.
And on ABC Radio National, we're now reaching for the longest novel on this year's Booker shortlist. It's The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by the Indian writer Kiran Desai. So this is a sprawling love story about two people, Sonia and Sunny. They're Indian nationals who are trying to find their place in the world. But this book is also about their families, their other lovers, and about India itself and how writers tell stories about this place.
And Kiran Desai is the only person on this year's shortlist who's won the Booker before, and she won that in 2006 for The Inheritance of Loss.
And at that time, she was the youngest ever woman to win.
Wow.
It's been almost 20 years since then. And in all that time, she's just been working on this one book. You can really feel the love and the care that has gone into this project. Now, Kiran Desai, I know all the other writers on the shortlist want to know, how does winning the Booker Prize change your life?
It did change my writing life. I think it gave me a feeling of some legitimacy. It was only my second book, and I was a very young writer. Perhaps it gave me the confidence to turn to a very different subject. Maybe it gave me the confidence to take this long while. I don't quite know, but it definitely altered my way of thinking about myself.
Yeah, and of course, this is in the family too, Kiran, because your mum, Anita Desai, was shortlisted for the Booker 3 times. You must have been hearing stories about the Booker for longer than you can remember.
That's right. And so when I say I'm a little bit scared of the circus, it's also because, you know, I lived through her having to go through this 3 times over.
Well, look, the new book is The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny. What did it start with?
It started with the idea of writing about loneliness in our globalized world and seeing that through the lens of a modern-day love story between two quite urbane, cosmopolitan Indians, brought up to leave India, really, expected to excel overseas. And somewhere along the line of writing across geographies and writing also about the other stories, family stories that influence their love stories, so going back in time historically, I realized that I could broaden the scope of this novel beyond romantic loneliness and look at all the divides in our world as a kind of loneliness. Mm-hmm. You know, the distrust between nations, the rage between races, class divide, the promise of feminism, the failure of feminism, are losing the natural world, which is happening so swiftly. So I decided to see all of these different aspects of our world as a kind of loneliness. That's why I think the book took so long too, because with such a subject, you can also go on forever. And I should say that not just the miserable aspects, but also loneliness as a kind of sustenance, you know, the pleasurable part of solitude, because I myself was experiencing quite an exquisite artistic loneliness.
I want to hear more about that. What is the pleasure of loneliness?
Yes. So I would say that the first Sonia, the character in the book, is a young college student in Vermont, where I was a college student. And that was where I, just like Sonia, experienced both, you know, the painful loneliness of being away from India, especially in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when It was still the days of aerograms, and it was before email. But I also experienced that exquisite artistic loneliness of writing my first stories in a snowbound college library and being so happy. And I've held on to that all of these years. And there's that extreme happiness of being alone with no eyes on you at all. So you lose all your self-consciousness when you're writing. That is exquisite loneliness.
So we've heard a little bit about the character of Sonia there. Perhaps you can introduce us to Sunny. Who is Sunny?
Sunny is an aspiring journalist. And I was thinking about Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who's a writer I admire so much. And I think it is in his memoir that he says that fiction and journalism are two wings of the same bird, two different ways of getting at the truth. And Sunny and Sonia are both young writers then, in a way, trying to locate their own story and to tell their own story in a world of these huge power divides, when they feel as if they're held at some part of this book is structured by who is held by whose gaze when it comes to the news or when it comes to art, when it comes to journalism, when it comes to countries. And I think one of the things that Sunny is very perturbed by is how the news changes shape as it travels from country to country. And he wonders how you can be a journalist when a news story is one thing in one country and pops up as a completely different story on the other side of the world.
I found this aspect of the book fascinating. You know, Sunny and Sonia both have these hang-ups about how they write about India, how their work will be perceived by audiences in India and outside India. They don't want to reduce their country to a cliche. You know, Sonia's warned not to write stories about arranged marriages or write magic realism. Do you have these hang-ups as well, Kieran?
Completely, I do. there are things that I think about a lot because I feel like if you are an Indian writer and your work is published overseas, and anyone perhaps from a non-Western country presenting their work internationally, your work will be seen politically. There is an anxiety in many countries, I think, as to how the landscape is being represented, especially if it has been historically underrepresented. And there's also the anxiety that these landscapes are being written about by authors who are somewhat compromised by their own experience. You know, so for example, myself being a very westernized author speaking in English, a language that's often accused of evading the Indian landscape altogether. So these things are in my mind, and the idea of putting forward books about exotic fruits, mangoes and peacocks and spices, you know, obscuring clouds of spices. And yet you also have to ask the question, exotic to whom? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's some truth to the argument. So there are arranged marriages in India. For example, most marriages are arranged, and yet Sonia's being told not to write that cliche about India. So the way I dealt with this was to include everything. Arranged marriages, but also divorces and love marriages, apples as well as guavas, and just to try to, and all of the questions that we've just been speaking about. All of these concerns.
Yeah, so there's so much happening in this novel, but at the heart it is a love story about Sonia and Sunny. What kind of love story were you interested in telling?
I was interested in telling a long, unresolved love story. and because, you know, I was thinking in the past of their grandparents who are, you know, their presence in this book, a love story would have been centered in one community, one class, one religion, most likely one place. And somehow people were always where they were supposed to be. And that's no longer true. People are not necessarily where they're supposed to be. And Sunny and Sonia are, you know, a love story out in the big globalized world can go in so many different directions. And it seems so much a matter of chance who you might meet, when, where. And they're always asking themselves, why this person? Why not someone else? Why this place? Why not somewhere else? And I think Sonia's father tells Sunny, you know, he says, and you're a young person, there's a reason to be out in the big world. There's always a reason. but in somewhere midway through life, you begin to wonder who you should have become instead of the person that you are.
And Sarah, when Kiran Desai says a long unresolved love story, the emphasis is on long. This is, I have to emphasise, a whopper of a novel.
I know, I had to go from the hard copy to an e-copy so that I could enlarge the font because they pack so much in. It takes more than 200 pages for Sonia and Sunny to even meet.
It does, but I found myself so taken with everyone else in this novel. I didn't mind that. I think Kiran Desai, she's taken so much time with this book. It's populated with this world of wonderful, fully rounded characters. There's Sunny and Sonia's friends, family and lovers. This is a book that you will love spending time with. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Claire Nichols, and today Sarah Lestrange and I are taking you through the six spectacular novels on this year's Booker shortlist. And the next two books, Audition and Flesh, we'll be meeting some very singular characters. Sarah?
Yeah, singular is a really good word. They're very distinctive voices. Let's talk about Audition first. It's the fifth novel by the American author Katie Kitamura. And it's about this famous unnamed actress and how she sees herself in her roles as actor, wife, and mother.
You know, I love books about acting.
Yeah, and it really brings up questions about, you know, the roles we play in our lives and how these might be different from how we're seen by the people closest to us. And all the while, this unnamed actress, she's struggling to find the heart of a play in which she is the lead role.
And this novel is divided into two parts.
In part one, this unnamed actress, she meets a young man in a restaurant and he claims to be her son.
And then in part two, everything changes.
Yes. In this part, which is the bulk of the story, it does change, but I can't say very much, Claire, very unhelpfully, because different people might have different readings of what's going on, which is kind of the point.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing, but what can we say?
Okay, so we can say that this young man, Xavier, who we met in part one, he's still in the picture, and so is the actor's husband. And what we see is how her relationship with each of them plays out and changes throughout the story, all the while she's performing in this play. It really is an introspective, taught exploration of the unreliable narrator, which is what people have enjoyed about it.
Yeah. Now, Katie Kitamura is not here. We just couldn't make the diaries align.
No.
So instead, why don't we hear a reading from Audition?
This is from part one, when the actress is reflecting on the challenge of her role in this new play that she's performing in, The Opposite Shore.
We were 3 weeks into rehearsal and I'd had an unusually long time to prepare, and yet I still felt myself too much to be playing a part. I couldn't seem to locate the centre of the role. This wasn't necessarily unusual. In the past, there'd been plenty of parts that had continued to elude me, even as the work as a whole improved. Whether through my own failing, or a failing in the writing, or the direction, or something else altogether. The alchemy was particular, and the truth was that there were many occasions when it went awry, or did not cohere. I had come to see it as something of a crapshoot. You never knew if this would be the one when everything would come together, or if it would fall by the wayside, another disposable performance, the detritus of a soon-to-be-forgotten artistic endeavour. But in the case of this part, this production, I had every reason to hope for the best. Not only was I working with Anne, but the play had been written by a playwright I had long admired. She was a young writer, exceptionally brilliant. I'd seen an early production of hers at a small theatre downtown that seated no more than 80 people. The theatre was half empty the night I went, although that changed as soon as the reviews came in, breathless and ecstatic. Then the tickets sold out for weeks in advance, and the run was extended twice, three times, by which point the writer had been garlanded in awards and commissions and offered a place in several writers' rooms. But even in a half-empty theatre with a cast of unknowns, I knew that she was an extraordinary talent. Tension grew out of every scene, scenes in which nothing took place and people said very little. And yet the pressure grew and grew, so that by the end of the play, I realised I'd been in a sickening state of unease for some time. And when I emerged from the theatre, I was simultaneously invigorated and physically exhausted, every nerve in my body still standing on end.
Well, I am intrigued.
And once again, that's a really good way to describe it, because it's an intriguing, somewhat beguiling book as the narrator's position shifts and changes throughout the story.
Okay, let's move to Flesh now. This is a novel by the British-Hungarian writer David Saloy, and this is the second time he's been shortlisted.
Yes, that was for All That Man Is in 2016, and there was this controversy over whether that novel, which is a collection of interlinked stories, actually met the criteria for the Booker.
Is there any doubt about this one, Flesh?
No. It's well and truly a novel, and we follow István from his teens in Hungary to life in England, climbing the social ladder, and then to his somewhat resigned middle age. It's really compelling, Claire, because of the way it's written. It's all about the form. There's this very spare dialogue, and the character is just put under pressure repeatedly, and even its beginnings were tricky.
Because I, in fact, abandoned another book, which I'd written a lot of, and this was, I guess, in 2020-ish. And I then obviously had to start again with a new book, and there was a sense that I couldn't really abandon another book. You know, you might be able to abandon one book, but you can't abandon two books in a row. Then it starts to look like a real problem. So initially there was quite a lot of pressure, I would say.
Was that coming from you or from your publisher?
More from me, really. I mean, obviously, the publisher, I had to ask for more time, and the publishers were quite understanding about that. But the way it works, of course, is that I wasn't going to get any more money from them till I delivered a book. So there was that too. But the main pressure was from me, and from a sense that I couldn't sort of, I had this one had to work. But once it got going and once I sort of felt that it was going to be something that was going to work, then I enjoyed it a lot, despite the fact that it's a lot of quite bleak things happen in it. Nevertheless, on one level, it was enjoyable to write, definitely.
And I was very drawn into this novel, David, and I'm intrigued by what drew you to explore the life of this main character, István.
Well, I was very sort of clear when I was starting to think about this book that I wanted to write something that had a sort of English end and a Hungarian end. My own life at the time was sort of stretched between those two places. I grew up in England and in London, and that's very much the place that I guess still think of as home ultimately. But by that point, I'd been living in Hungary for many years. I have a Hungarian family. So I reached a point where I wasn't entirely at home in either place in a funny way. And so I wanted to somehow write a book that reflected that and that somehow, I guess, made a virtue of that aspect of my life at the time. And then to have a character, Hungarian character, who emigrates to the UK seemed like a fairly obvious way to go in terms of the plot and the story. So I just sort of grew from there.
And when we meet him, he's a sullen teen. He's living with his mother in a small flat. And he's seduced by this 42-year-old woman who he describes as ugly and old. And even though he's not attracted to her, he's sort of drawn into this world. And this, it seems to be a foundational moment in his life. How does it shape his life?
Well, I think obviously it's extremely important and, as you say, foundational for the whole book. At first, I think when you say he's not attracted to her, I think it's probably more complex than that, actually. He sort of is, as well as thinking that he shouldn't be. And it obviously also sets the course of his life in some ways, both emotionally, in terms of it sort of sets up a pattern, which is then repeated in various ways later in the book. And also as a result of an episode of violence, which takes place directly as a result of this involvement with this woman, it really affects the course of his life in a narrative sense too.
And it must be intentional that a book called Flesh is beginning with this moment of desire.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's very physical. The plot of the book is built around mainly physical events, you know. So, and the book itself sort of takes a view of István and the other characters. It looks at them first of all as sort of physical bodies. Obviously, the title of the book is intended to reflect that.
I know this has been talked about a lot, but the dialogue in this book, it consists mostly of him saying, okay, I don't know, sure, or repeating a question. And I mean, that shouldn't work, but it does. Why do you think it does work?
Well, I mean, the dialogue I kind of had, initially I sort of was just almost sort of having fun with it. It was, I wanted to make sort of write very realistic dialogues. I almost kind of bloody-mindedly realistic dialogue, in that it's just the sort of repetitions and circularities and sort of non-meaningful grunts, basically, that constitute a lot of real dialogue between people in reality. I wanted to try and reflect that, bring that in. And I think, for one thing, it can be quite comical, and I hope that it brings some comedy to the book at various points, the sort of extreme deadpan nature of that. It does help to feel the reality of things, I guess. I mean, it's part of the book's realism. And the emotional engagement which the reader has with István, I guess, is partly based on a very real, very strong sense of his reality and the reality of his world, which is very much the contemporary world in Europe. So from that point of view, it's also important. And it's amazing how much can be communicated by that sort of dialogue, really, because extreme sort of subtleties, which the reader will understand on some level, you know, the word okay can mean a wide range of different things in different contexts.
You really do push him to extremes, beginning with that affair with an older woman. He then goes to juvenile detention, joins the army, has fluctuations in wealth, and is exposed to death at every corner. Why were you wanting to push him to such extremes? Not everyone has, you know, ends up in juvenile detention when they're teenagers.
No, sure. I mean, it is quite a dramatic. I mean, the book, I didn't want to sort of shy away from extremes of experience, I guess. I wanted to include them in the book. I mean, I guess most people's lives don't include quite as much extreme experience of one kind or another as István's does, but most people's lives include something of that, and those, obviously, just because they are extreme, tend to be very important to people's experiences and to the shape and nature of their lives. And I just wanted to sort of see how far that could be taken.
That's David Saloy talking about his Booker shortlisted novel, Flesh. And you're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National, where now we're going to pick up the final novel on this year's Booker shortlist. It's The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz. And this is a road trip novel. It is narrated by Tom. And years ago, when his kids were small, his wife cheated on him. And in all the years that have passed, he's been telling himself that one day, he will leave her. And then that day arrives. He does it. He drives his youngest daughter to college, and then he just keeps on driving.
And meanwhile, he's not well either. His body is breaking down in strange ways.
Yeah, and that reflects Ben Markowitz's own health crisis, which inspired this book. Ben, can you start by telling us a little bit more about your narrator, Tom, and where his head is at when this book opens?
He's sort of at a loose end at that point. You know, he's given a lot to his family life. His kids have left home. His marriage isn't what he wants it to be. He's on leave of absence from work. He's a law professor because he's said something a little controversial in one of his classes, and they put him on leave to quieten the aftermath. And he doesn't really know what to do with himself.
Okay, so he drives his daughter to college, and then he's meant to come home. But he doesn't. What does he do instead?
Instead, he sets off across the country for a couple of reasons. So he's in New York. He drives his daughter to university in Pittsburgh, and he's got a son in Los Angeles, right the other side of the country. And he starts heading west, partly to end up in Los Angeles, where he's going to see his son. His father's buried there as well. But along the way, he stops off to see other people who have been significant in his life. His brother, a college buddy, and an ex-girlfriend.
And he keeps talking to all of them, but I'm not exactly sure what he is hoping to get out of these interactions with these people from his past. Does he know what he wants from these catch-ups?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he had been emotionally adrift, and now he's also physically adrift. He has a sense of urgency in his life, but no real object for that urgency. He doesn't know what it's going to lead him to. And at one point, he sees the possibility when he's visiting this ex-girlfriend that he could have lived a totally different life, and that terrifies him.
I also like that he keeps dropping to each person he visits, "I might be leaving my wife." It's almost like he needs to say it out loud to someone to see how it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted the book to be loving. I mean, I know even though it's a book about a guy in some sense running out on his life and his marriage, he spends a lot of time thinking about her, Amy, his wife, and what went wrong. And in some ways, he finds it easier to be close to her when he's away from her and just trying to figure out what had happened to them than he does when he's in her presence, because the kind of habit of friction they've developed over the past however many years of their marriage makes it hard for them to see each other as clearly as they are capable of seeing each other.
This is ultimately a road trip novel, Ben. It's a classic format, particularly in America. What about this form is appealing to you?
I've done a few American road trips. And in fact, this road trip was very loosely based on one I took with my family, not without my family, a few years before. We drove from Texas, which is where I'm from, to California. And I was getting sicker with the same thing that Tom has. And like Tom, I didn't know what it was over the course of that road trip, which in an odd way really intensified and kind of enriched the experience. I felt the preciousness of it all in a way that I think Tom is beginning to as well. I mean, part of the appeal of the road trip is that at every point, every new place you come to, you think, I could start my life again here.
You mentioned your health, and you also mentioned your narrator Tom's health. Let's start with Tom. What's going on with Tom health-wise? Because he's not in a good state.
No. So when I started the novel, I had the same symptoms that Tom has at the beginning of the book. He would wake up in the morning with a bloated face and leaky eyes. He would go jogging and suddenly have to stop because it's like the energy source had been pulled from the plug. And these things were happening to me. I kept going to the doctor. The doctors couldn't figure out anything wrong. And this is what happens to Tom. And I partly gave him these symptoms because it seemed to be in keeping with one of the themes of the novel, his sense of midlife decline. Mm. And I thought it might be interesting to explore his physical decline as well as the other ways that he felt his life had gone off center. And then by the end of the book, Tom had a diagnosis and I had my diagnosis, which is that I had lymphoma. And I was going through chemo when I finished a first draft of the novel.
Can I ask how you are now, Ben?
So far as I know, I'm in remission. I feel okay. I feel good.
Going through chemo while finishing a book, can you just talk me through how going through this terrible health crisis affected the writing of this novel?
It did actually affect it quite powerfully, partly because when I first planned the book, I didn't plan it that carefully. I had in mind a slightly different ending. I wanted to leave Tom totally abandoned as he drifted west. In ways, you can see little glimpses of it in the book as it exists, you know, the things that might have gone wrong for him. But my experience of getting sick and being diagnosed was not that I felt abandoned. In fact, you know, I mentioned that at the beginning of the novel, I gave him these symptoms partly because I wanted to show the various ways that he was pushed off the center of his own life. But I felt nothing but at the center of my life when I was sick. You know, my wife was amazing. My kids were great. And the warmth of all my friends made me very reluctant to end the book the way I'd originally intended, because I just thought it's not plausible. You know, when the things that matter happen to you, I feel like the feelings that matter rise to the surface, and those feelings are often very loving, and that's how I wanted to end the book. And so that was partly because of you know, my medical condition.
You spoke about the urgency that Tom feels on this trip, despite the fact that he doesn't really know what's happening in his life. Did you feel that urgency in the writing of this novel?
It was, I mean, it was important to me. As I said, I was finishing chemo and I wasn't sure. I was going through chemo when I finished the book, and I didn't know if I would keep writing when I was going through chemo, you know, because it kind of knocks you out. Mm. And I obviously, I didn't write on the first few days after each treatment. But it did, was very important to me to give me a sense of having done something each day, a sense of the shape of my life that had continued. I mean, in an odd way, being a writer was good practice for chemo, because you just have these routines every day that you're trying to get through. And that was very important to me when I was being treated. And so the book, finishing the book, working on the book, made me feel like myself in a way that was important to me at that time.
I'm so pleased to hear that. I really like this book, Ben, and I think a huge part of the appeal for me is the very conversational style. We basically have this character, Tom, appear from the first page, tell us my wife had an affair 12 years ago, and he just keeps talking to us. He's going to wherever his thoughts take him. How did you land on this very conversational style?
I guess as much as possible, I would like to write the sorts of sentences that I could actually say, because I feel that if you do that, it will seem real in a way that lets you get away with all kinds of ordinary observations and small details that become important because they feel real. Mm. The example I use I teach creative writing. If you exaggerate everything and make it super vivid, it can sometimes feel like you're playing with Monopoly money, and nobody cares about Monopoly money. But if you can use an ordinary language and ordinary details, it might feel like you're playing with real money and people care about real money.
Ben Markowitz, his beautiful novel, The Rest of Our Lives, is our final book on this year's Booker shortlist. And Sarah, as I just said to Ben, I really love the conversational style of this novel. Tom is this character who, from the first page, he just doesn't want to stop chatting with you. Also, I think the conversations he has on the road, they feel very real in that way that sometimes, or perhaps all the time, we can really struggle to say what we actually want to say.
Yeah, that seems to be a bit of a theme with this shortlist. Between this book and Flesh, there's some great realist dialogue in the shortlist. And I do wonder if that's the influence of Roddy Doyle being on the judging panel.
Yeah, I mean, he is arguably the king of conversational writing, Roddy Doyle. He's always going to love it, I guess, when other authors do that well.
But the big question, Claire, who's going to win the Booker this year?
Oh, okay, I'm going to go for Flashlight by Susan Choi. I think it's really propulsive. The characters are wonderfully, terribly flawed, and it deals with this really fascinating piece of history with those Koreans in Japan. This is a book I couldn't put down.
I think we're on the same page, Claire, for all those reasons. Oh. I just found it really edgy. I loved the political background, the impact of that war. What do we know, though, Claire? So good luck to everyone. The winner will be announced on the 10th of November.
And thanks to you, Sarah Lestrange, for helping to guide us through the Booker shortlist today. Thank you also to operator David LeMay.
And we make the book show here on Wurundjeri land.
And here on Whadjuk Noongarrbuddja.
And next time on the book show, you and I are starting the celebrations for Jane Austen, who was born 250 years ago this year.
Yay, I have been so looking forward to this. It's going to be a delight. Get your bonnet ready. Until then, I am Claire Nichols. Take care.